Welcome to Book Me Podcast, sponsored by Nimbus Publishing. I'm Lindsay Glode Rainingbird. Join me as we journey through contemporary Canadian literature, reading as much as we can and chatting with authors, illustrators, and other bookish folk, celebrating our dynamic, diverse, and vibrant national literary scene as we go. So grab a snack, get cozy, break that binding, dog-ear those pages. Let's dig into it. Today, we're joined by Zoom, award-winning author Leo McKay Jr. to talk about his new novel, What Comes Echoing Back, a story of teenage trauma and resilience in the age of social media and the way music has the ability to help us connect and heal. I was completely drawn into the very different yet equally devastating stories of Sam, who with her two best friends suffers a brutal assault, and Robert, or Robot, who accidentally kills someone in a fistfight gone wrong. And then the unexpected, tentative, and touching friendship they develop as two outsiders. This is a book that will break your heart and then fill it back up with hope. It's a really, really great read. Welcome to the podcast, Leo.
Thank you. I feel welcome.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. My husband went to CEC and he said that you are like the cool teacher at the high school.
I remember your husband. I don't think I taught him. Your husband
you
is Gerald,
didn't.
Right?
Yeah, he is, but he's very musical too. So he always remembers you and thinks of that.
I remember him very well as a guy who was a good musician.
Yeah. Well, he was, I think, blue haired in high school. So it was a little bit more punk. I don't know. But as a longtime teacher, how did that influence and shape how you created the teenage characters in this book?
Well, I think when I start writing a novel, because I have a full-time job and stuff, as actually most writers do, most fiction writers anyway, it takes me a long time to write a novel, and I have to choose material that seems appropriate to me. I have to choose a story that I think is important. Important enough that I'm going to be interested in it for 10 years. I try to choose something that I think I am uniquely positioned to write about. And because by now, at this end of the 10-year process of writing What Comes Echoing Back, I've been a high school teacher for almost 30 years. I feel like I know that world pretty well. Also, the 10 years of writing this particular book coincided with the 10 years that I was a father to teenagers. My kids are all in their 20s now, so I'm no longer a father of teenagers. But when I started writing this book, all three of my kids were in the teenage years. And so I really felt like that was a world that I knew something about. And
you saw both sides of the coin. You get the kids when they're at school being that particular type of person, and then at home what's really behind the mask. Yeah,
that's right. And you go through this stage as a teacher in a smaller community like this, where suddenly you're teaching kids, not just your own kids. I taught all three of my own kids. But you're teaching people that you knew since they were six, and now they're 16 or 17. And so, you know, your kids' friends or whatever, acquaintances or classmates. And so you just kind of understand their lives from several different perspectives, you know. So you see this person in the classroom, and, you know, I just felt myself very aware of everything that led up to that person being there in the room in front of me at this moment.
Well, and there's some very brutal things that happen in the book, but I felt that the way you approached it was with so much tenderness and just care that I really appreciated it, the way that you wrote those themes and that whole, all the situations. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I think that's one of the reasons why it takes 10 years to write a book like this. I knew I wanted this book to go to some dark and scary places, because I think that's a whole real aspect of life now. And especially, you know, the lives of teenagers get distorted and amplified by social media in a very particular way now. And so it was a big challenge of me for me to make sure that I was showing the darkness to its fullest extent without being overwhelming. But also, I wanted to write a hopeful book, and a book that kind of finds its way through the darkness to some kind of non-cliche light. And so that's what I hope I have achieved. And so I'm glad to hear you say that you kind of, you read the book that way.
Well, I think you did achieve that, definitely. And also, there's so many books lately and shows and everything that depict teenagers with these just like the darkest possible ways you can be a teenager and live in this world right now. And I just felt that was really nice to have a little bit of light and hope at the end of the tunnel, and maybe even a way to navigate those kind of things that aren't always depicted.
And I think I wanted to portray a world in which bad things can happen to people, and people can learn to kind of deal with that and to go forward in a positive way.
Definitely. So you definitely showed the evils of social media and technology here with the way that the kids are kind of re-traumatized or pushed into things that they wouldn't normally do because of the way they're interacting with social media and their phones on them all the time, kind of unable to escape their phones. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on if there's redeeming qualities to social media for teenagers, or even if this book could have taken place in a different time frame, what, like in the 90s, what that might have looked like to you.
Well, there's a couple of sides to that. I cannot imagine this book taking place 10 years prior, because the substance of what happens to these characters, you know, bad things have happened to people and are done by people at all eras of human history. But I think the very particular way that these characters' lives are affected by their social environment, that's really peculiar to the social media age. And I do think social media does more good than harm. I think it's a mistake to talk about, to focus only on the bad stuff for social media. Social media really enables people to make connections and to maintain connections that I think can be very positive, and in a way that was not possible before social media. So, you know, I even think, like, in the book, Sam is portrayed as like connecting with the music of Edith Piaf. Well, how is she going to do that? Like, how would a teenager, that I think it's completely realistic that a teenager could find the music of Edith Piaf and connect to it today. That's a completely possible situation. And she does it through modern technology. And so I think somebody like her, who really does not have a whole lot of personal resources, she doesn't have serious musicians in her life to kind of connect her with musical stuff like that, information. Previous to the social media age, she would not have had access to that. And, you know, the character of Robot, earlier in the book, in the kind of flashback sections to the previous year, he manages to make a connection to some other musicians at his school who are kind of coming from a different world and different background than him, but they connect through social media, right? He's watching this one character that's called Trumpet Boy. He's watching Trumpet Boy's YouTube page, and then he finds out Trumpet Boy is obviously watching what he posts on YouTube. And that's how they make that connection. So although I wanted this book to explore as fully as I could the kind of negative side of social media, I think without question, there is an enormous, we have gained a lot from social media. And I think it's important to keep that in perspective.
Definitely. I'm also from the generation directly before all this happened. So I didn't even have a cell phone when I was in high school. So I was like, and then right after that is when everything started to go wild. I graduated in 2003. But I thought it was really interesting also kind of how you touch on this dichotomy between how social media kind of doesn't let you forget things that happen, but also it can also work as proof. Like it's almost like things don't happen unless you have that proof on your phone, that text message that was screenshotted, that video of something horrible that happened to you. So it's a really weird balance of, well, these things don't go away and they live forever, but they also prove that this happened.
Yes.
You know, it happened to you, and it's almost like evidence at that point. And I feel like when I grew up, and maybe when you grow up, rumors and without any kind of evidence to them had a lot more stickiness to them. They had a lot more credit. And now it's pics or it didn't happen. Like you have to prove that it happened.
That's actually a very good point. And I, you know, you're telling me that maybe that's a kind of insight that you gained or was reinforced for you by reading the book. And it's an aspect that I have not kind of fully thought about. But I think there is that kind of that's another aspect to the kind of two-sidedness of it. Like I think, you know, Sam in the book hears about like this terrible thing that robot did, but she also inadvertently kind of sees somebody in a classroom playing a video of it. Mm-hmm. And so that solidifies in her mind, okay, this is not just a rumor. This is not just something someone's made up. This is something that really happened. And I think also for her own experience, she kind of sees this evidence of what happened to her. And it's so the first time she sees it, she's confused by it. She doesn't even really know. She doesn't fully understand that she's looking at herself.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Frightening. But then there's also that kind of he said, she said thing comes completely out of play because you see exactly what happened with Robot. You see exactly what happened. And if it wasn't caught on video and shared so widely, you maybe wouldn't have known that it was that accidental. Like, you know, he maybe would have been, you know, like you could have been convinced that he did it on purpose or that it was more intentional that it was. And the same with Sam, if it wasn't horribly captured on video, you maybe there would have been even more of that kind of not believing her, what she says.
It's interesting, this whole kind of dichotomy of like there's the good side and the bad side is kind of baked into the idea too, the title of the book, What Comes Echoing Back.
I love the title, by the way.
All right. Thank you. It was arrived at through a lot of, one of the kind of interesting things about this book, at some point I'm going to make a list of all the titles that this book has had while I was working on it. There's a lot.
10 years of titles.
Yeah, that's right. That's what happens. But part of the concept of this book and its relationship to the idea of echoing is related to perhaps, I think I have maybe a misunderstanding of this concept of audio reverberation. And, you know, the echoing in the book mostly refers to the way that our lives get played back to us on social media. But there's also stuff in the book about just like what it's like to be in like an empty space and to hear echoes. And there's an incredibly kind of positive aspect to that. And I think one of the things that musicians understand is the importance of reverb and the kind of dimension that reverb adds to music.
Okay, what is reverb though?
Reverb is, I don't know how to describe this scientifically, but reverb is a kind of echo. It's a kind of mild echoing
like
feeling.
Vibrations too.
It's a vibration from a room, basically, or the space that you're in. It gives the sense that the sound is being made in a space. And if you look at reverb controls on musical instruments, some of them actually say small room, large hall, right? So there, it gives you the kind of illusion that you're in a little space or a big space. And early on in the writing of this book, I saw this documentary about this scientist who was an expert on acoustics. He studied sounds, and he had this whole team of people with very sophisticated measuring equipment. They went into one of these European cave systems where people had, for tens of thousands of years, painted on the walls of these caves. And through this sophisticated kind of measurement of the spaces where this activity was taking place, this scientist concluded that the paintings in those cave systems were in the places with the most reverb. And he hypothesized, based on this, that the making of those cave paintings was probably accompanied by some kind of singing or chanting. And it has a powerful effect, that the sense of being in a space and hearing this sound come echoing from the space through your ears, there's some kind of semi-mystical power to that. You know, I wanted to portray the kind of negative side of echoing, having your life played back to you on the internet, whether you want to or not. But there's also this incredibly positive association with the sound of echoing that I tried to infuse the book with as well.
Right, because Sam and Robot kind of have this friendship that begins in stairwells where they start to play together and sing together.
Yeah, and there's a couple of different scenes in the book that take place in a stairwell where they have gone. One is at a school, one is at a hospital, where they go because they know if they make music there and sing there, it'll sound incredible. And they don't really have a theory that they're using. They're not applying some kind of theoretical framework to their understanding of it. They just know, like, if you go there and play music, it sounds amazing. And so they're drawn to that.
Yeah. And it's kind of like a tentative thing at first, because Sam obviously is not interested in the enclosed spaces, but it's just a really beautiful way to bring her a little bit out of her shell. And
yeah, that first scene where she goes into that stairwell and she goes in there reluctantly and she doesn't fully go in, right? Because she's been traumatized and she knows she's not going to feel safe in that space if she goes in there and lets the door close behind her. That was a scene that I really had to work on over years to get that scene right, to get the scene to feel like, okay, she's like, I think the first drafts of that scene, I think, would have led a reader to say, why is she going to go in there?
That's creepy. Don't follow that guy. You do get a very like tender and like loving side to Robot. And I just love the character of him and how he's this really big dude, but he doesn't carry that kind of presence of being a big, scary dude.
He's not insisting that she come in either. She stops at the doorway.
Yeah. He's like, you do what's comfortable for you. Yeah.
Yeah. And he goes farther up the staircase first where she can't see him. And then she's like, you know what? I this is as far as I can go. I think she says in that scene, I have a thing about doors.
Yeah.
Which is about the most she's comfortable saying at that point. And so she kind of stops in the doorway and he comes down and says, all right, maybe we'll go up further. The sound's better up there. Maybe we'll go up there further next time.
What a beautiful and simple way to just illustrate consent. Just like that simple.
Yes.
She's not comfortable. He comes back down. Like, that's fine.
Yes.
So you have an excerpt for us today?
Yeah. I have just one paragraph here. And this is at the beginning of chapter 6. This is a scene that's a very important scene to me. because this is a scene that shows Sam's name in this chapter is not Sam yet, because of what happens to her kind of publicly. Her kind of name and image are spread around on the internet. She becomes kind of detached from her name at one point in the novel, and she ends up kind of renaming herself. So her name in this chapter is actually Trisha, but she's with her friends. She's with her friend Morgan, and she's with her friend Becky, and they're in Morgan's bedroom. And this is just before the bad things happen to those girls. And I wanted this chapter to portray a number of things. Sam's longing to do something creative that she comes back to later on in the book when she is drawn to learning music. But I also wanted this scene to portray this very positive relationship among these three teenage girls. And this is the first paragraph of that chapter. Trisha wants to remember this feeling, the warmth and the quiet contentment. She is propped at the end of Morgan's bed. Morgan has a weighted comforter, and even though the room is at a comfortable temperature, Trisha has it tucked around her body, its pressure like a reassuring hug. Across the room, Morgan is absorbed in drawing, black ink on the creamy paper of a sketchbook. From where Trisha is propped, half lying down, half sitting, she cannot see the image Morgan is working on, but she recognizes the deep tranquility of Morgan's posture, the slow sounds of Morgan's deep breaths as she sinks into her creative mode. Trisha gets her own vicarious tranquility from doing this. She loves and admires her friend's absorptive state. She envies Morgan's artistic side. She's always wanted to do something creative like Morgan does, to draw or paint or play music or write poetry. But she can never seem to muster the focusing power. Her mind scatters off as soon as she tries to draw together its attentive faculties. So that paragraph to me is about the kind of the contentment she feels with her friends in that chapter. And also there's a little hint of discontent there. Part of what I was going for in that chapter was like to show that she was a happy, well-adjusted person before this terrible thing happened to her, but also to show like she's longing for something more.
Yeah.
Which is not, an unusual thing, I think, for teenagers or anybody else.
Definitely. I love how you depicted the three friends and that kind of sisterhood that they have together. It felt very real to me, and it just reminded me so much of all the many afternoons I would spend just in my friends' bedrooms, all not doing our own thing even and not interacting. There's this just funny little thing that you wrote in one of those scenes where you talk about a bowl of cherries and how Morgan comes from a more well-to-do family. And so her mom just gives them, or she just grabs this giant bowl of cherries from the fridge. And Trisha's just like, to live in a house where you can just have a giant bowl of cherries and not think about how expensive they are and not think about maybe they were being saved for something, like to have that kind of peace of mind. I don't know. That just really struck me. I was just like, what a wonderful way to illustrate that.
Well, thank you very much. That's an aspect. That's something I grew up with a very clear awareness of kind of class differences or kind of income differences in a way. I always hesitate to call the neighborhood I grew up in poor, because nobody in that neighborhood ever used the word poor to describe themselves. But I grew up in a neighborhood that's not very well off neighborhood.
Financially aware.
Yes.
Very financially aware. Yes. Same.
And I recall going to one of the things about a smaller public high school in a smaller community is, you end up making friends with people who come from very different backgrounds than you. And, I can remember moments in my own teenage years of going to some friend's house and looking around the house and going, wow, look at this. You know, I remember even just this moment in this guy's house, his dad was a doctor, and they had a painting on the wall, and the painting had a light over it just for the painting. And I remember going home telling my parents, there's a light. They have a like, what a stupid little detail to stick out for me. But the fact that this painting had its own light was a big detail that stuck out to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I have two small children. So that's my goals going forward, is I want them to have big bowl of cherries, peace of mind. Like, that's that would just be nice. That's what I'll always say from now on. But just to finish off our conversation, I always like to know what authors are reading. What was the last book that really touched you or spoke to you? Or what are you currently reading now?
I'm usually reading several books at the same time. At the moment, I've got two books on the go. The book that I'm reading on paper, because I'm also listening to an audiobook, I'm reading The Overstory by Richard Powers. Are you familiar with that book?
I've heard of it.
It's a very unusual book. I think it won the Pulitzer Prize. Yes. I think it was published in 2019, maybe. And it's a book. It's a kind of book I don't usually like. I find big, fat novels of 500, 600 pages, I get lost in the middle of them. I think, you know, Henry comes in chapter 43 and I go, who's Henry? I can't remember Henry. But this book so far, I'm about a third of the way through, and it's a book in which it's all about trees. This book is mostly about trees and the people's relationship to the trees around them. So it's very much a kind of environmentalist book in a way, but it achieves that in a very unusual way. Like, I think one of the things that people talk about in The Overstory is it's a whole that people are calling a whole new kind of novel, where it's not just the human characters that matter. It's like the stuff around them that's playing an important role. So I find that very interesting.
Oh, that sounds interesting. I love environmentally based novels, but also there's just been so much research that's come to light recently about how plants have like all these different ways of seeing and stuff. And like trees have entire networks underneath them and like help each other. So it's very cool, like how plants are communities, basically.
That's 100% what this book is about. And one of the characters in the book is a scientist who, early in her career, writes a paper on how trees are communicating with each other, both underground and above ground, because the root systems are joining together and they're sending off these chemical signals to each other. And she has a lot of evidence for it, but basically early in her career, she's mocked for it. First of all,
nobody was going to believe that. Yeah.
And first of all, it's kind of sexism, because all the other scientists at that time are male, and they're just like, who's this woman that is talking about trees talking to each other? And then, you know, I'm just at this point in the novel where she finds out that 30 years down the line, there are scientists who've taken up her early research and are going forward with it. So I've also, you know, recently I've been reading a lot by Claire Keegan, the Irish writer. Her novel, Small Things Like These, made a big splash a few years ago. And I've just recently read her story collection called Walk the Blue Fields. And one of the things that really struck me in that story collection is, in some of the stories, that the animals in the story and even some inanimate objects are given a point of view. And it's not done in some ridiculous or silly way. It's not like done satirically. It's a kind of whole different perspective on human relationships by contextualizing them with animal relationships and with the relationships people have with the inanimate world. So I think that's an idea that I find interesting right now.
Yeah, I'm going to have to pick up those books. So can we assume that what's coming next from you might be an environmentalist type of novel.
I don't know.
In the next 10 years?
I don't know. I really don't know. I know I'm working on a number of short stories right now.
Oh, great.
And one of the stories, I hate talking about this stuff because it just jinxes it and then it all falls apart. So this story probably will never turn into anything that actually works. It's certainly not working in its current form, but it's about a relationship between a man and a crow.
I love crow stories.
Oh, crows are amazing.
Crows are crows.
Animals.
Yeah.
Crows are it. And the story actually includes the crows' point of view. So that's one of the things that's kind of sent me on a kind of search for fiction that's dealing with relationships with animals and
okay, you're gonna
world.
Have to workshop that into a full novel because that's what I would like to read next. But I know we have to wrap this up, but I wanted to tell you about a book I just bought called Hollow Kingdom, which is about a zombie apocalypse told through the point of view of a crow.
Oh,
who's
really?
Who's like a domesticated crow, and he's like seeing all this happen. So I haven't read it yet, but that tagline was like, yes.
Well, I'm just going to write that down. Hollow Kingdom. Great.
Anyways, thank you so much for joining me today. I love talking to you about your book.
Thank you, Lindsay. I really enjoyed this conversation.
What Comes Echoing Back by Leo McKay Jr. is available now everywhere books are sold. And thank you for listening and hanging out with us. Join me next time on this book lover's journey as we try to read more, read Canadian, read local. You know, all the good things.